The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast, where the finals are here. It feels like the finals just left, but the finals are back. And just like we all thought 8 months ago, the Milwaukee Bucks will be in Phoenix facing the Phoenix Suns, the same Phoenix Suns who have not played in the playoffs since 2010 in the 2021 NBA Finals in a matchup that I think, as we're about to get to, is actually quite intriguing. These have been the two best defensive teams of the playoffs by quite a bit. Actually, they're first and second in defense for the playoffs. Here are their net ratings and offensive and defensive efficiency for the regular season. Milwaukee, offense, 116.5 points per 100 possessions. That's pretty good. Phoenix offense, 116.3 points per 100 possessions. Whoa, 0.2, that's it. Defense, Milwaukee, 110.7 points per 100 possessions allowed. Phoenix, 110.4. These teams could not be any closer on paper. I think they bring actually some similarities in terms of schematic flexibility, personnel, how they're built, how they can play defense in one way and then maybe morph into another way. And hovering over all this, obviously, is the status of Giannis Antetokounmpo, the two-time MVP, who injured his knee in the latter stages of the Hawks series, the conference finals. And, you know, it's always hard to talk about a series when you don't know if the best guy is going to be available and at what state he's going to be. On the one hand, I think a very limited Giannis, like if he's 60% or something, could, this may sound sacrilegious, in some stretches, actually hurt the Bucks because he's not James Harden as a shooting threat where it doesn't matter if he's running around with one leg, you still have to guard him 35 feet from the basket. Giannis, without his athleticism, without his burst, without his shot blocking, without his rebounding, is often going to clog space for the Bucks on offense. And we saw when that space opened up in the last few games of the Hawks series, suddenly Brooke Lopez was dunking and dunking and dunking, and Bobby Portis was dunking and floating and looking at people with his self-proclaimed crazy eyes. And that's because the paint was open. On the other hand, if Giannis can't go, I don't think the Bucks can win the series. I think the Bucks can make it a competitive series because they're still really good without Giannis. But I just think the lack of depth plus Phoenix just being rock solid top to bottom would wear them down. And we'd be looking at a Suns in six at worst, maybe, scenario for the Suns. So that's where I am coming into the finals. Let's welcome in to preview the series. X's and O's, adjustments, everything. The one and only Kevin Pelton. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you didn't even mention, by the way, these teams literally could not have been closer in the two regular season matchups, which were both decided by 1 point, one of them in overtime.
I'm excited. I know when people say they're excited about Bucks Suns, you're like, well, of course the NBA nerd is excited and he's trying to finger wag, you know, that, oh, everyone should really get into Nikola Jokic and all that. Like, it's actually, I just think these teams are both really good and they match up really well. Is there anything I said in my little mini intro that resonated with you before we break down the two sides of the ball?
The part about the importance of Giannis to this being a good series, I think that resonated. I mean, it's definitely, we seem to be in a better place than when, you know, he first went down and you're looking at this worst case scenario of Phoenix against an overmatched opponent in the finals, whether it's the Hawks with a limited Trae Young or the Bucks without Giannis. And so the potential for him to play at some point in this series and hopefully look something like what he did, you know, over the course of the playoffs is certainly an encouraging one that, you know, after a playoffs that have been marred by injuries, hopefully we cannot have those be the dominant storyline of these finals.
And I do think, you know, I just, as good as they looked in closing out Atlanta without Giannis, and again, Trae Young only played the second of those two games, and Trae Young clearly was not 100% in game six. I just don't think they have enough juice and enough steam to beat, with essentially like six guys, to beat the Suns, who are deep, assuming Cam Johnson's ready to go, who are deep and talented and just don't have any weaknesses really and play just good players every minute of the game. I just don't think, and they have home court. I think without Giannis, or with Giannis severely limited, this is Suns in six at or Suns in five. And with Giannis, it's just hard to know what conditions he's in, but I am excited. So let's just dive right in. I want to split this up to when Team A has the ball, what are we looking for? So let's start with the Phoenix Suns. When Phoenix has the ball, and you can start anywhere you want, matchups, lineups, schemes, whatever. We know Phoenix is Chris Paul, Devin Booker, Mikal Bridges, Jay Crowder, DeAndre Ayton, four out around Ayton, two elite pick and roll ball handlers. The Bucks, for most of the playoffs, have started these gigantor lineups, whether it's Holiday, Middleton, Giannis, Tucker, Lopez, or Holiday, Middleton, Tucker, Portis, Lopez with Giannis absent. I don't know if we should pretend Giannis is playing or what, but when Phoenix has the ball, Mr. Pelton, what's the first thing you're going to be looking for?
Well, I'm going to start the same place that I did when we were previewing the Eastern Conference Finals on this podcast, and I guess it's appropriate because Kevin Arnovitz and I did write a piece last week arguing that it's all about the pick and roll, so we should start at that point and how Milwaukee is going to defend it, because it's really fascinating after the evolution we saw in their pick and roll defense over the course of that series against Atlanta. We talked a lot going into it about the success they'd had in the regular season in the one matchup that Trae Young had played in using the drop, keeping Brook Lopez close to the basket, take away the lob to Capella in that case, and John Collins, and try to make Trae Young shoot from the mid-range. And then Trae Young shot like 150% on floaters in game one of that series, and Lopez was on the bench in the fourth quarter. And even though he played the rest of the series, they played a lot less drop coverage. I wrote about this on our keys to the series on ESPN.com, and you know, it went from, they'd been playing about 40% of the time soft coverage according to Second Spectrum through game one of the Eastern Conference Finals in the playoffs. That went down to 26% games two through four, and most of those going to switches. And then in games five and six without Giannis, they dropped on just 9% of Atlanta's pick and rolls. So do you just start that way in this series, knowing that you've got two mid-range marksmen in Devin Booker and Chris Paul on the other side?
I don't know what they're going to do. I thought it was really interesting. So game five, Giannis and Trey sit, and the Bucks decide, okay, we're just going to switch everything. Let's just keep it simple. We're switching everything. Even with you, Brook Lopez, we're switching with you. You're going to go out and guard Kevin Huerter and Bogdan. We're switching everything. Then game six comes and Trey plays. And I thought, well, they'll probably not switch against Trey. I bet they revert back to some sort of different coverage with Trae Young, because do you really want Brook Lopez dancing out there with Trae Young? And what did they do? They switched everything anyway. And so I think one of the reasons I think this series is interesting is I think both of these teams have the ability to play lots of different looks defensively, even when their sort of behemoth centers are in the game. So I think we will see Lopez drop a lot at the beginning of the series, because that's just what the Bucks do. But I think we'll see him come out higher. And we saw even with Zubats as he eased into that series, if you just come out a couple steps higher and you start to learn the timing of those guys, you eat up enough space so that when they get to their comfort zone, you're kind of there to contest those shots. Zubats got a better rhythm. So I think we'll see Brook do that. I think we'll see him switch some and just say, let's see what you can do. Now, I don't think you can count on Brook Lopez doing well enough against Devin Booker and Chris Paul over a full series to win that way, as with that as your like defense on, I don't know, 50%, 60% of pick and rolls. Ironically, I think Chris Paul's time in Houston, he was not this big isolation, let's dance with the ball one-on-one guy before he got there. Obviously, he could do it. Obviously, he could torture big guys on switches, but Houston had him lean into that, and that could come in handy here. Who knows? They could even put Brook Lopez on Jay Crowder and say, we're going to put Giannis on Ayton and switch everything. I doubt we'll see a lot of that. We don't see Bud do that. But, you know, I think the last two games of the Hawks series are a little bit of a harbinger, because I think if I'm the Bucks, I feel a little emboldened to at least late in the clock, at least in some possessions as a changeup, that we're going to switch more, even with Brook Lopez.
The one thing I do wonder how it intersects is personnel, because I didn't watch live as it was happening that last Bucks-Suns game in April that went to overtime. So I didn't realize that Giannis in the first minute of overtime, actually when Devin Booker was driving to the hole against Brook Lopez on a switch, Giannis comes over to erase that shot and save a bucket, but in the process rolls his ankle and misses the rest of that game. And it's fascinating that when he came out at that subsequent timeout, So did Brook Lopez, that Bud decided that those guys were kind of tied together, and they instead went to P.J. Tucker at center, put at that point they could put both Pat Connaughton and Dante DiVincenzo in on the wing along with Middleton and Drew Holiday, who are the givens there. That's obviously not an option here because you got the DiVincenzo injury, which you know often gets kind of overlooked in the Bucks' lack of depth when Giannis is out. But
huge blow, and I'm glad you mentioned it because both of these teams are getting a little crap for you know, benefiting from injuries along the way. And they both clearly did. Like, I think Brooklyn wins that series and maybe going away if both Kyrie and Harden are healthy and probably even if just one of them is healthy. But these two teams were not entirely unscathed either. Dante DiVincenzo is a big part of their team. In this series, he would be huge as just a utility defender. Like, when Holiday's on the bench, he takes Chris Paul. If you want to spare Chris Middleton some time guarding Devin Booker, well, okay, you can go guard Devin Booker, Chris Middleton, you go guard Mikal Bridges. He would be huge.
But so to back to the point, I think part of what that was Bud saying, if we don't have Giannis there as a secondary help defender, we're less comfortable with Brook Lopez being away from the basket or stuck in these one-on-one matchups. And that's kind of the thing that, you know, in those Clippers lineups with Zubats at center, same thing. You don't have that secondary help defender. So maybe their willingness to play Brook Lopez and switch him is in some ways contingent on Giannis's health in this series.
I think another wild card is just what are the matchups? So in the regular season, Drew Holiday defended Chris Paul. Chris Middleton defended Devin Booker, and you go down from there. And DiVincenzo then was the guy you stashed on Mikal Bridges. Not that you can, I mean, Mikal Bridges is good. I'm not just saying you can just stash a guy on Mikal Bridges, but he's not going to be on the ball as much as these other guys. And now Tucker presumably is in the lineup, is in the lineup in DiVincenzo's place. And we saw him guard Trae Young quite a bit in the last series, and particularly toward the end, as I think their idea was, well, if we're going to switch everything, let's start with a bigger guy on Trae Young so that when we switch a bigger guy onto John Collins, who was like, up, by the way, preposterously efficient on like crazy difficult post-up shots in that series. Like every time he made one of these 18-foot leaners, I was just like, okay, I guess he's just going to make them. So I don't know. Like, I think one of the wild cards is like, who does P.J. Tucker guard? Do you put him on Devin Booker? Do you put him on Chris Paul? I think everything's in play.
Or if Giannis doesn't play, do you consider getting Connaughton in there and going with Tucker and a smaller front court with Tucker and Lopez instead of starting Bobby Portis? Because that's, I guessed wrong. That's, I thought, what the adjustment was going to be after Giannis went down for games 5 and 6. And instead, the Bucks decided to sort of lean into their strength, their literal strength and size, and go that way. But, you know, Connaughton, I think, is going to be a really important player in this series for all those reasons you mentioned, that they're going to miss DiVincenzo. He's the closest facsimile that they have to that.
And he was outstanding the last few games of the Atlanta series. He's a great rebounder. He's a good defensive player, and his three-point shooting is always going to be a bellwether for the Bucks. If he goes 2 for 4 or 3 for 5 versus 1 for 5, it's obviously a huge difference because he's going to get dared to shoot. I think another Phoenix has the ball thing that's just really interesting is Phoenix is just fiending on corner threes. I think they were number 3 in the percentage of shots that were corner threes in the regular season. And you want to say, well, Milwaukee gives up a ton of threes and that's by design and that's how they play. But they're one of the best teams in the league at preventing corner threes, which all of the threes they give up are longer above the break threes. So just one of the things I'm going to be watching is, and we saw this is how they smoked Denver, is just they got Denver in rotation, swing, corner three, all the pick and roll trickery that the Suns have, flare screens, the Spain pick and roll with the back screen, all that cool stuff completely flummoxed the Nuggets. If the Bucks, I think the Bucks, whether they drop back or switch or have Brook Lopez sort of live in that middle ground, I think all of those schemes are kind of tailor-made for them to limit corner three. So that's just one of the battles I'm going to be watching is, can Phoenix generate those shots? Because we saw when the Clippers went zone and when the Clippers started to switch everything, all of a sudden Bridges and Crowder were not involved at all and not getting those shots.
Yeah, I mean, you're not trapping, you're not putting two on the ball against pick and roll, you're not hard hedging, and those are the ways that you tend to get more in rotation and give up those corner threes. I feel like there's going to be more opportunities for Phoenix to get to that secondary stuff off the pick and roll against the Milwaukee bench units when it's Bryn Forbes in there, or, you know, God forbid, the Jeff Teague, Thanasis Antetokounmpo minutes. Like, there's a bit more mistake prone with that group than with the first unit, which is going to be a lot tighter in terms of making those mistakes.
Yeah, I haven't looked up Thanasis's fouls per 36 minutes in the playoffs. It's got to be, we've got to be in near record territory. The guy is just a human foul. He plays so hard and he just runs into people, and it's delightful. Yeah, I mean, when the Bucks have their four best defenders out there, Holiday, Middleton, Tucker, Giannis, if you want to include Middleton in that group, they just have a lot of answers for you. Like, they should and will switch 1-4. I mean, and you can say on Phoenix that doesn't really matter. They don't run a lot of pick and roll with anybody but Ayton, but they run the Paul Booker two-man game sometimes. They have a lot of sort of prelude screens where they have the guard screen for each other before they go into the pick and roll to try and get a mismatch. And, like, that stuff isn't super dangerous to the Bucks if they have all their guys on the floor. I think both of these teams have some good answers for each other, honestly.
Well, I think the last thing that we haven't really discussed when Phoenix has the ball is how much of a factor is Ayton if you are switching. You know, that sort of came and went over the course of that series against the Clippers. It was the thing that the Clippers were evidently scared of, why they, you know, didn't go to that small lineup and continue to play in Zubats and DeMarcus Cousins so much in the first four games of that series before Zubats went out. But, you know, it didn't seem to concern Milwaukee too much in that overtime when they went with Tucker as their biggest guy on the floor. I mean, that's a smaller lineup than a lot of the ones the Clippers are playing, because Tucker's 6'5 himself. So, you know, you're really going particularly undersized. Middleton, I guess, is your tallest player in that group. So, and Ayton wasn't a big factor in that overtime session, you know, where Phoenix did go on to win that game. So is he capable of what we saw in game 6, or is it going to look more like game 5? If the Bucks are switching and putting smaller players on him?
Yeah, we've seen that when the Bucks go small, and in the playoffs, that's mostly been like Portis at center without Giannis or Lopez in the game. So like Middleton's your power forward. Those lineups are pretty squishy defensively. They're pretty vulnerable. And when they go super small, I don't know how sustainable that is without Giannis. Maybe it is more sustainable than I think. But I do know this. Their best small lineup, which is Holiday, Connaughton, Middleton, Giannis, Tucker, is plus 31 in 55 minutes in the playoffs and has been really, really good. So yeah, to your point, you know, you started off with Brook Lopez and the drop coverage, right? That's the first thing we talked about. This is, and we talked about the corner threes and all that, but above all that is the Suns take the fourth most mid-range shots in the NBA in the regular season, and the Bucks give up the fourth most in the NBA in the regular season. And so if both play to their normal strategies, and again, as we discussed, maybe they won't. Chris Paul and Devin Booker are going to have a lot of chances. And like sometimes that just comes down to not necessarily warping your scheme, but just playing it a little better. Brook Lopez, can you come up a step and a half more? Jrue Holiday and Chris Middleton, how close are you getting around those screens? Do they feel you? Do they hear you from behind? Are you disrupting their line of sight at all? Sometimes it's just... it's just that. And the other thing is Phoenix takes care of the ball. They're one of the best turnover teams in the league. That's a Chris Paul trademark. If they can win the possession battle a little bit, I think that helps them. And underneath all that is the offensive rebounding. And we saw in the last series, if you start switching everything against Chris Paul pick and rolls and Devin Booker pick and rolls, DeAndre Ayton's going to have a lot of chances on the offensive glass, so that'll be interesting. But the flip side to that is when the Bucks switched and that matchup chaos happened, you saw Bobby Portis get a lot of easy post-up buckets against guards because those switches carried over. Like there's all those things are sort of enveloped in how do you defend the base pick-and-roll attack of the Suns. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think that gets to the question that has been interesting for the Bucks during this playoffs of shot volume. Can they get more shots than their opponents? Because that's how they've survived the fact that they have not shot the ball particularly well in this playoffs. If we transition over to talking about when they have the ball, but you know, they may not be able to have that kind of edge against a team with Chris Paul at point guard and DeAndre Ayton at center on the offensive glass.
the possession game and the shot game is going to be interesting. These are two teams that do not get to the line hardly at all. They're in the bottom of the league in generating free throws, which for TV viewing purposes or just audience viewing purposes is very good. Anything else you want to discuss before we move to the other side of the ball, which I think is even more interesting, frankly?
Yeah, I think we've covered it.
Okay, well, let's flip. Milwaukee gets the ball. What's the first thing you're looking for? And again, it's hard to talk about the Bucks, so we don't know if the big guy's playing. But what's interesting to you about this Milwaukee offense versus Phoenix defense?
Well, I want to start with what I just mentioned is them surviving their lack of shooting. The Bucks have shot 31% on threes in the playoffs. There's, I think, only three teams have lower marks, and it's like teams that have long been eliminated months ago. If you know, I would have told you over the last couple of years, given how identified the Bucks are with shooting threes, that they would shoot this poorly and still make the NBA Finals. I don't think you would have believed it. It's the lowest three-point percentage by any team ahead of the NBA Finals that reached them since the 2004 Detroit Pistons at 30%.
So, and I think Jrue Holiday is shooting 29.9% on threes in the playoffs. And there are these games where it's like Forbes gets played off the floor, or they don't trust his defense enough to play him. It's like Chris Middleton is just a Superman from three, and nobody else is doing anything.
The good news for the Bucks is the percentage you've shot over the first three rounds basically tells you nothing historically about how well you're going to shoot in the finals. So maybe eventually it's going to come around. I mean, in the Brooklyn series in particular, it seemed like you could explain it as, okay, well, they've gone from aren't getting the catch and shoots because of the Nets switching. They're shooting all these off the dribble threes. That's not really their strength. And then there was also the fatigue element of all the minutes that Holiday and Middleton were playing and the defensive assignments against the Nets stars. And then that didn't really apply at all in the Atlanta series in the same way. And yet they still didn't make shots. Like, you keep waiting. Eventually the Bucks are going to make shots, right?
This is the story of the Mike Budenholzer coaching era in Atlanta and Milwaukee. Whenever they don't win, it's because they just haven't made open shots well, but they have managed to survive. And by the way, when they lost that game five in Brooklyn, falling from like 18 points ahead and like their offense basically went into the blue screen of death mode. Like, just someone unplugged your appliance and it stopped working and they had no idea what they were doing anymore. I did an emergency podcast that night with Wendy because to talk about Durant, who went, you know, bananas, beyond bananas, super duper bananas. And I said, look, this feels like cosmic death for the Bucks. This game, it's just all the Budenholzer stuff wrapped into one horrible game and you're down 3-2. And I said, but you have to zoom out. You got game six at home. You got a really wounded opponent. You got Atlanta and Philly kind of slugging it out on the other end. And like, you're just better than Atlanta, and Philly is giving you zero confidence that they can figure out their own freaking issues. And then you're in the finals. And that's exactly what happened. They persevered. They leaned on their defense, and they deserve a ton of credit for just gutting through bad losses, ugly losses, adversity, injury. Like, it's not the prettiest run. It doesn't necessarily make me think that they've like solved any structural problems other than the fact that Giannis has clearly accepted and leaned into his role as a screen setting big man, which for Milwaukee's long-term trajectory was a must happen and has happened. But they're here. They're in the finals and they should apologize to nobody. When they have the ball, let's just start right off the bat. I'm interested in the matchups. In the regular season, DeAndre Ayton was the primary defender on Giannis. We've seen a lot of teams put their centers on Giannis. They also have Jay Crowder, who was the primary defender on Giannis in the Heat-Bucks series last year and did quite well in a series I think most of us thought going in, Bam Adebayo would get that job, but Jay Crowder got it. And so I think that's going to be interesting. If DeAndre Ayton is on Giannis and they do use him as a screen setter a lot, well, is DeAndre Ayton going to switch? Is he going to drop? How are you going to navigate that? And again, Tucker, I think if I were Monty Williams, I would put Chris Paul on PJ Tucker and say, we're going to try and spare you as much as we can. We're going to put Booker on Holiday, Mikal Bridges on Middleton, which were the matchups a lot in the regular season, and go that route and dare you to try to hurt Chris Paul, who's not a weak defender, but just he's old and has been banged up and he's short. Dare you to as we saw with Trae Young, dare you to involve PJ Tucker in the offense. And if that's the case, you know, your next best thing is if Jrue Holiday has Booker on him, if there's a weak link defensively in Phoenix's starting five, and it's weak only by comparison. Devin Booker is a solid defender. He's weak only by comparison. I think you got to lean into that Holiday, Giannis pick and roll, because if I've got Bridges on Middleton and Crowder or Ayton on Giannis, I might switch the Middleton-Giannis pick and roll, which has been my bread and butter. But if I'm forcing the Bucks to lean into Holiday instead of Middleton as a ball handler, I feel like that's a slight win for me. You know, Drew's just not as good of a shooter. And we saw in the last couple of games, his decision-making can really go haywire sometimes. But I just think, like, how would you set up the matchups? Do you like Ayton on Giannis? Would you put Ayton on Lopez? Do you like CP on PJ? Like, how do you set the chessboard?
So I think that Ayton on Giannis is interesting because you mentioned a lot of teams do this. But Phoenix, I feel like, in some ways set the template. This was a game back in March 2019 where they beat Milwaukee at home. It was weird. I rewatched a little bit of the first quarter of that. And it's like, oh, Dragan Bender is involved in this game. And he's on Phoenix, not even his stint on Milwaukee, which feels like a million years ago.
By the way, this is the Dragan Bender Bowl. It's the Torrey Craig Cash Considerations Bowl. It's the we don't have Eric Bledsoe on our team anymore bowl. It's a lot of bowls.
There's some weird ties between these franchises. But obviously, you go back to the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar coin flip in 1969. And Torrey Craig is going to be an interesting one because he could be a factor in this series.
He's going to be a factor. I love that. Torrey Craig is on a revenge tour. Nuggets, revenge. he's getting revenge. He's like freaking the bride from Kill Bill, just checking him off the list.
And I do think, by the way, the other structural problem the Bucks solved, even though Drew isn't shooting the ball well in the playoffs, just having him out there instead of Bledsoe has solved a lot of structural problems for them late in games and the threat that he can be. But yeah,
yes, big upgrade.
Yes, sorry, that was stating the obvious, but that was a structural problem.
And by the way, like, I hate that because it sounds like Eric Bledsoe is a good basketball player. He's a good player. I thought he was a borderline all-star both his years in Milwaukee. He's a great defensive player. The lack of shooting just proved fatal in the playoffs. It doesn't mean he's a bad player. It just means Drew Holiday's, because of his shooting threat and his kind of more polished off the dribble game, just a better player. That's why they traded all the stuff they traded for him.
Yeah, I mean, Bledsoe's more of an 82-game player. But anyways, so Ayton was kind of the proof of concept. And it's funny because that was at a period of time where everyone was like, well, you know, how terrible is Ayton going to be defensively? Can you survive with DeAndre Ayton as your center? And now 2 years later, we've come to the point where he's, you know, perhaps a plus at the defensive end of the court. But his athleticism and his size just made him a tough matchup for Giannis at that point. And I think it still makes him a tough matchup for Giannis, although maybe it's a little less desirable as a matchup now that you maybe want Ayton more around to serve as a help defender. But Giannis, when he doesn't have the ball, maybe does allow you to play that role as well.
And if you do put Crowder on Giannis, you can really easily switch the Middleton-Giannis pick and roll because you're switching between Bridges and Crowder. I say all of that knowing that Mikal Bridges is giving up a whole lot of weight and strength against Giannis. If you make that switch with 16 on the shot clock, it's a big problem. If you make that switch with 4 on the shot clock or 7 on the shot clock, it's much less of a problem. I'm very interested to see what they do. I think they will switch Ayton a little bit. They'll try to drop, and Ayton is a little more agile than Brook Lopez, can come up a little higher and get back. I'm working on a story about DeAndre Ayton's defense. I talked to him the other day. He was great, just talking about all the progress he's made, just feeling out how far is my big man rolling behind me. How much distance do I have? Am I there? Should I be more worried about that, less worried about that? I think he's gotten a lot better at that. And they've been very good at, if you watch the tape, if they switch a player onto Giannis who's too small, right? So if they switch Booker onto him, even Mikal Bridges, they're very good at, okay, where is somebody bigger that can run in and rescue this guy and not give up an open three? Crowder is great at that. Bridges is good at that. I think we're going to see that. And just like the Bucks, I think the Suns are like well equipped to defend a lot of these, you know, two-man games, a lot of these actions. They just have a good Bridges, Crowder, Ayton, even Booker, like a pretty good switchy defense. And Chris Paul's going to fight. And Chris Paul's a beast in the post. I just think they have a lot of interesting answers. One of which is, one of the things about putting your center on Giannis is that if and when Milwaukee, and we saw this with Brooklyn, if and when Milwaukee goes small to that lineup I mentioned that's plus 31, it doesn't really bother you because the matchups are basically the same. Like, you, like, okay, you went small. That's great. You didn't really add shooting because Connaughton and Tucker are on the floor. So there's not a ton of shooting. You're not stressing me out because I already had Ayton on Giannis and now he's playing center. So everything, like, they're just not, their core lineup is not bothered by that Milwaukee adjustment. And that's like, that's almost like the Hawks were bothered by it because they couldn't play Gallinari, Collins, and Capella against it. One of their best lineups was taken off the floor. The Suns are like, it's cool. You do that. It's like, fine. We're just going to play normal.
Yeah, there's just a lot of versatility in those Phoenix front courts in particular defensively, and a high basketball IQ defensively across the board in those Suns groups, and that's the reason that they're here. I mean, that's a lot of it. And if you come down to making a pick under the assumption that Giannis is going to be close to 100%, I think what you mentioned there is a big factor pushing me towards Phoenix.
In terms of what did I mention?
In terms of them not being stressed out by Milwaukee's small ball, or that not being a trump card for the Bucks.
Yeah, I'm going to pick Phoenix. I mean, look, if Giannis were 100%, I don't really know who I would pick, but I'm going to pick Phoenix. I think it's going to be a good series, though. Another thing I'm going to be watching if Giannis does play, I thought the last 4 or 5 games against Phoenix, and even in previously, not against Phoenix, against Atlanta, sorry, and even in some previous rounds, I thought he was doing a little bit more to work as a passer. Like a couple of his kickout looks were like half a second earlier, a beat earlier than they would be. Like he was looking to exploit the help early instead of when it was too late, and got his guys good looks. And I think at the highest level, and now we're at the finals, at the highest level, that's how he's got to have that sort of awareness. And I thought he showed good signs of that in the last couple series.
Yeah, it was making the right decisions of when to pass early and when to go and attack because of the fact that you do have an advantage and your defender is, you know, off balance or at an angle so that you can go around them instead of going through them and pick up the offensive fouls that we saw a lot of during that Brooklyn series and relatively few of in the games he did play against Atlanta.
Last thing that I think we should mention is the Bucks were, pick your metric, the best, second best, third best transition offense in the NBA all season. They're just a monster fast break team. Again, when the big fella plays, when Giannis plays. The Suns are really good at keeping teams out of transition, which again, is just like they're fundamentally rock solid, well coached. Guys are put in the right positions. No one is chasing an offensive rebound they shouldn't chase. Guys are getting back, all that stuff. But by the numbers, at least, when you run on them, teams have been able to score pretty efficiently. And that's one of the potential downsides of having an offense where there is a player in each corner almost all the time. Because if they get a rebound, you got two guys in the corner and one is just a little late going back. Probably the shot that's been missed is a drive or a mid-ranger by Chris Paul with Ayton rolling. You got four guys below the foul line. That's going to be just another little game within the game that Phoenix is going to have to nail, because if Giannis plays, you just can't let them get out and transition any extra.
Especially the maneuver that they perfected over the course of the Atlanta series of when you do have a big man, you know, closing out on a guard, Trey, Lou Williams, leaking out immediately, and worst case scenario, that guard has to follow you down and you've got a mismatch at the other end. And you know, our buddy Nate Duncan tweeted during Game 6, you'd hope Atlanta had a better plan to deal with that. And I'm honestly not sure what that is without compromising the structure of your offense and your spacing there.
I think this is – I'm just crossing my fingers that we get good Giannis, healthy Giannis. I don't think we're going to know if he's even playing until pretty close to Game 1. You got to figure he really wants to play, man. I mean, you only get so many – it's why James Harden played on one leg. You only get – it always feels when you get there the first time like, oh yeah, this I'll get back here. Bucks are pretty well positioned to get back there. Really good team, pretty young. Nobody's ancient. You just never know. But I think this is going to be a good series. I think my official pick is going to be Suns in 6. Did you make your official pick yet?
I haven't made it yet, but I'm leaning towards Suns in 7.
Suns in 7 is the home court advantage, obviously becomes critical there. All right, Mr. Pelton, you have some keys to the finals, or a key to the finals, up today on ESPN.com. You will be writing about all things finals for the next week, 10 days, 2 weeks, however long this thing lasts. And then right into the offseason. Boom, draft, free agency, let's go. Kevin Pelton, you are one of a kind. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It was very odd to have a 4th of July where there weren't a bunch of free agency transactions.
Oh, I did enjoy it. Like, it's already the 4th of July. Like, it's a holiday. The 4th of July is a holiday. So you don't have to be like, this is the 5th anniversary of Kevin Durant signing. No, it's just the 4th of July. That's just when free agency is usually going on. It's also the 4th anniversary of Gordon Hayward signing with the Boston Celtics. No one is tweeting about that. And I loved KD's response, like, yo, it's a holiday now. It's already a holiday. It's just the 4th of July.
6th anniversary of LaMarcus Aldridge signing with San Antonio. I can remember.
Was that July 4th?
It was, yes. I don't know how many years it's been since Steve Nash got signed and traded to the Lakers, but I can definitely like tell you my Independence Day is by the NBA moves that happened on that day.
It was strange, actually. It was strange because I woke up and I was like, huh. I mean, I got to watch some Bucks Suns film, but there's no I don't have to be refreshing Twitter all day long. All right, KP, I'll see you soon, bud.
Thanks.
You know that instant confidence boost you get from an outfit that makes you look really good. That's what you'll get with Stitch Fix. With Stitch Fix, you get a stylist who understands your style, size, and budget, and they do all the shopping for you. It's the easiest way to update your wardrobe this season. You got to update your wardrobe for every season. Even I know that. Just give the stylist your size, style, and budget preferences. Order boxes when you want, how you want, no subscription required, and they send 5 just for you pieces, plus outfit recommendations and pro styling advice. You keep what works and then send back the rest. Your stylist sends just right pieces and the fit is always on point. It's like they have style ESP. You'll be shocked at how they do it. Stitch Fix makes it all so easy. If you don't like to shop, they save you all the time and effort. That sounds great to me. Plus, you get outfits that make you look really good and feel really good. And if you don't love something, you just send it back. Shipping, returns, exchanges, all free. Style that makes you feel as good as you look. Get started today at stitchfix.com/low. That's stitchfix.com/low. L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, stitchfix.com/low.
The Low Post fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite The Low Post episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like First Take and Pardon the Interruption ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/low. That's amazon.com/low to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I could not be more excited about this. When the Bucks made the finals, I was like, I got to get a Bucks person on here because I did the whole Suns euphoria thing with the Suns fan at ESPN. I need a Bucks person. And the first person I thought of, he just won't do it. He's too busy. He's too good. Marcus Johnson, 5-time All-Star, UCLA star, and now just one of the best analysts working in sports, period. When there is a Bucks game on television, get the Bucks feed. I don't care who the other feed is. Get the Bucks feed because this guy is sitting courtside, or I don't know where he was sitting this year, and you see the game at such a high level in real time. I have to rewind to see the stuff that you see, boom, as it happens. Matchups, adjustments. You're funny. You're on the spot. You got the numbers. It's just, I don't know that there's one person in broadcasting who is bringing all of those elements to the table every single game. So it's really a thrill and an honor to have you on. Marcus Johnson, how are you?
Wow, Zach, thank you for the
Oh, I've written all that before. I've written that in columns. Like, that's not new.
I've seen it. You're right. But it's funny you mentioned that, and I won't mention this NBA executive's name, but I had some interactions with him when he was with another team. And he texted me during our broadcast when we were playing against his team about some stuff that I had said, and he just kind of reinforced what I was saying on the air. So I was like, well, hey, man, what are you doing watching our telecast when your telecast is on? He's like, I always watch you guys over us. It's not even a question. So that was one of the highest compliments that I could get. But I appreciate that, man. We have a good time. Jim Paschke retiring this year after 35 years as a Milwaukee Buck broadcaster. has really been a pleasure to work with. Gus Johnson, I started out with also. So I've worked with some really talented people, and the product has been good. The organization is great, and it's just been a great run these last 6 years.
And Doris Stevenson has been an awesome addition to the team. Like, it's just top to bottom, a great broadcast. So you were on, you know, I grew up an 80s NBA fan. I'm almost 44 years old. So I grew up Celtics, Lakers, Celtics, Sixers, Lakers, Rockets, the whole thing. And there was one team that was always right there, always scared me as I was a Boston fan growing up, always scared me. I was like, these guys are kind of rough and tumble and scary, and they got dudes who could score. And that was the 80s Bucks. And you've been associate, you were on that team, you were an all-star on that team. Now you're a broadcaster in Milwaukee. I just, as someone, and you guys just always came close. And those Philly and Boston teams were just so damn good. You couldn't quite ever get over the hump. Just what has the last couple of weeks been like as a Milwaukee person, as someone who played on those teams, seeing this team finally get to the finals for the first time in so long?
Well, it's definitely been a vicarious thrill for me. And it kind of happened and was magnified game 7 against Brooklyn. And I've been in 3 game 7, my rookie year against Denver, the Sonics, my third year in the league, and then the Sixers around my 4th to 5th year in the league. And we lost them all, but we were close. And so I actually posted something on Twitter just about the mindset going into a game 7. Don't leave anything, no stone left unturned. You got to make, because you don't want to look back like I do 40 plus years later and wish you would have made a defensive adjustment with Brian Winters on an inbounds play down 1 in the spectrum with Bobby Jones taking it out, you know. And I, you know, so those kinds of things just stay with you. So for the Bucks to pull out the game 7. And the funny part about that game 7, Juneteenth, was that I was actually at my granddaughter's high school graduation. So I didn't get a chance to see the whole game. It was at the SoFi stadium. They've got a nice little performing arts center, beautiful graduation ceremony. And so we rushed home after that, and I caught the last 3 minutes of regulation, all of overtime. And so that was enough. And that's probably all I could handle. God knew what he was doing. He doing for me what I couldn't do for myself that day. But the point is that once they got past Brooklyn and then finally won a game 7, the Bucks had never won a game 7 on the road in their history, yada, yee, yada, yay. But that to me was the moment when I felt like this is going to continue to be our year. And to see Giannis and Chris Middleton, the guys that were here when I started 6 years ago, their development as players, as people, as family men, has, you know, that's always a good thing to be a part of and to watch. Not you know, from I won't say from afar, but you know, we're not great buddies or anything like that. But to be able to observe that happening in real time, right before your very eyes, has been an honor for me. So this organization, man, you know, I'm not just blowing smoke. This organization is to me top shelf, one of the best, if not the best, in the league. And this is well deserved in terms of all the hard work and the vision that Peter Fagan and the ownership group had when they purchased the team, like what, 7 or 8 years ago. So. It's been a ride.
What are those last 3 minutes of regulation and overtime like in the Johnson household? Can you sit? Are you pacing when Durant's shot goes in? Are there bad words being screamed? Like, I got to know. Take me inside the household.
Well, so it was my granddaughter's graduation. So my sons are here. All my sons are here. I got 5 boys. Everybody's in the den, on sprawled out on the floor, on couches. My wife is sitting next to me. She's a big Bucks fan. My son, Chris, my oldest son who played at UCLA, he's a big kind of KD guy. So he was actually kind of pulling for KD to have another phenomenal finish. He was cool with the Bucks winning, but he kept, so me and him are going back and forth. So I'm telling him, Zach, that, you know, the 48 minutes that Steve Nash played him in this series in a couple of games, the fact he hadn't come out in this game, it's going to catch up with him eventually. I'm telling you, man, it's got to catch up with him. And it took the last possession of overtime when he shot the air ball. I really would say that possession before that, when he didn't get behind the 3-point line, could have won the game, the last shot in regulation. But just for whatever reason, I think fatigue might have had a bit of a factor in that, maybe not major, but somewhat. But to be able to do what he did was just special to watch. But for the Bucks to win it the way they did in Brooklyn on the road, man, we were going nuts here. We were going crazy. Everybody's yelling and screaming. And I'm like, I'm working, like I'm getting paid to do commentary. I'm just kind of walk, but more of a kind of Ebonics-laden type profanity laced.
Yeah.
kind of color commentary. You that him, never man, that's all, you know, F him, you know. And I, you know, and I'm a Christian guy, so I'm not proud of that, but man, all that goes out the window when I'm excited and pumped up, especially about this team.
You know what? What was not talked about on that last possession, by the way, the last Brooklyn possession where it ended with the Durant air ball.
Yeah.
When Durant was, they didn't call timeout, and Durant brings it up and he passes it off to Harden, who, and you could tell Harden was like, dude, what are you doing, man? I got one leg. Like, here, right, you take right. it back. When he threw that pass, I remember turning to the guy I was watching, like, oh, that's not, this possession is not, that was just a weird moment that I feel like was lost amid, you know, yeah. Kevin Durant's greatness, the Bucks winning the game. Like, when that pass happened, I remember thinking, oh, ooh, they're not going to get a basket on this possession.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to just, you gotta, you know, playing 50 plus minutes or whatever it was, playing the whole game, scoring 49 a couple of games prior to, this dude had to be just on, not even on fumes. I mean, just really gasping for like last breath type air and all that. And when that happens as a player, I mean, you know, say fatigue makes cowards of us all. But not that he was a coward in that situation. But you're just not thinking straight, and your mind is foggy, and everything's running together, and you know, it's hard to stay in the moment, and it's a whole lot of challenges that go on when you have played as hard and as well as he played for that amount of minutes. So I'm with you. I mean, when he gave the ball up, it's like, okay, wait a minute. You know, it's almost like a plea for somebody else, kind of take this onus off me, a temporary plea. He knew he had to take that shot. But if Harden would have been aggressive and would have tried to win it himself, I don't think KD would have minded.
I've been in Milwaukee a lot the last few years, not since the pandemic hit. I've been in the Deer District. I'm watching the Deer District on TV, and I'm like, my God, that is a sea of humanity. This place is going nuts. Milwaukee, I know some of our ESPN colleagues who I love kind of disparaged Milwaukee a little bit a couple of weeks ago. I love those guys. They're entitled to their opinion. Milwaukee, like Chicago, like a lot of Midwest cities, spring and summer, oh my God, is it nice there. So what, you've been walking around, like, what is the city just on fire? Can you go, are people high-fiving you in the street? Like, what's life like?
Yeah, no, the city is, it's crazy. And I'm actually in Los Angeles now. I'll be there for game 3 at home. I'll be in Phoenix tomorrow night for the opening of the NBA Finals. But I'm getting all these texts. So my barber, Diedrich, the lineup king, that's what I call him, man, just a great barber. But Diedrich King, he sends me, well, actually, one of my good friends in Milwaukee sends me a picture of Diedrich just bawling like a baby, just crying after the Bucks are going to the final. And my boy Lance was like, yeah, your boy Diedrich's taking it kind of hard, man. He's all emotional. He's all in his feelings over these Bucks right now. But it was a beautiful thing. And then that's the kind of dedication that these people in Milwaukee, these fans have toward this team. And again, to have it happen the way it did for the Milwaukee Bucks this year, you know, the city deserves something like that. We've got a running gag, me and Ted Davis, our radio voice. Ted always says that, you know, we can't have good things in Milwaukee. Something always happens, whatever sport it is, something happens to kind of ruin things. And it looked like that might be the case when Giannis went down with the hyperextended knee. But, you know, finally we had the breakthrough, and it's a beautiful thing.
Let's talk about the series. It's hard to talk about because, you know, the two-time MVP status is uncertain, and obviously there's the Bucks with Giannis and the Bucks without Giannis, and the Bucks with him are not only more talented, they just play differently. It's the whole thing changes. But what intrigues you about this matchup? As you did the Suns games this year, they were both epic regular season games. You know these teams, as you know the visiting team, the other team, is well or better than anyone in your business. What sticks out at you is an interesting part of this matchup. Why are the Suns so good? Just what are you looking for when the game tips?
Well, Chris Paul, I'm one of his biggest admirers. Just watching him throughout his career. You know, when you read about his pawpaw, his grandfather dying when he's in high school, his grandfather was 63 and he goes out and scores 63 points in the game. I mean, that kind of legendary stuff kind of gets it started. Followed him with the Clippers. I was doing talk radio with Jeannie Zelasco in Los Angeles in his Clipper days, and saw him kind of have challenges with that team. Great team, Lob City, all that good stuff, but never kind of have the breakthrough in the postseason. My point is this, Zach, is that when he was with Oklahoma City last season, And I'm thinking it's a rebuild year for them, and he's just going to be there to tutor the young guys, and they're not going to do anything. And they have success. So then you know that what this guy – I've always said that he's one of the greatest leaders in professional sports history. And the fact he's been president of the Players Association, I think, 5 or 6, 7 years, some crazy amount of years, is indicative of the respect that he has amongst his peers. My point is, man, I had to go up to him when he was warming up at Oklahoma City in Fiserv Forum before our game last year. It was a little brief moment where he was kind of broke away from the layup line. And I went up, put my arm around him and said, man, look, I am so proud of just kind of how you've conducted yourself, the way you've repped yourself as a player, as a person throughout your entire career, thinking that it was over. Oklahoma City would be the last stop. You know, he'd stay there a year, 2 years, and kind of ride into the sunset, and it's all done. Now, all of a sudden, here this dude is in the NBA Finals, and the numbers that he has put up have just been mind-boggling in terms of what he has done as a closer. I've got the numbers here. With 27 out of 35 of their last points against the Clippers in Game 6, 25 of 37 second-half points against the Nuggets in Game 4, you know, that gives you an idea how badly he wants this. So my point is, that's the guy that you've got to find an answer to. You're not going to stop him, maybe not even – I don't know if you can slow him, but you got to do something to try and break up his rhythm a bit. Maybe blitz him some off of screens, switch whatever you're going to do. You've got to try and attack him. You see, you chop off the head, the body will fall. He's the head. And my final point with Chris, I mean, I've always been this proponent of waiting until after the NBA playoffs to give out the MVP award. He has really been, I call it the real MVP. I mean, Jokic, great year. Don't get me wrong, I'm taking nothing from here. But just like Giannis was MVP, Kawhi was the best in the league that year. Giannis MVP again. LeBron James was actually the real MVP in terms of start to finish. Chris Paul right now has a chance to kind of fit into that mold of being the guy that has really had the best season from start to finish of anybody. So to me, that's the key. But also their mid-range game, more and more tangibly, mid-range, they kill you in the mid-range. Devin Booker and Chris Paul and Bridges and those guys, they get to their spots, and that's what the Bucks like to give up. That's how our defense is predicated on teams having to knock down floaters and mid-range jump shots. Well, we haven't had success 2 games against this team from the mid-range, so I'm sure that Coach Budenholzer and staff are diligently working on a game plan, a scheme to kind of try and thwart their effectiveness as a mid-range team.
You know, I didn't mean for this to become the Marcus Johnson is awesome hour, but when you're talking about Chris Paul being the real MVP or in your head, the sort of full season, regular season of playoffs MVP, in my head started thinking, well, I wonder what that means for his opinion of Giannis's 2 MVPs. And I didn't even have to ask the question. Yeah. You just answered it. And what I'm saying is, I should have mentioned this in the opening. You are not a homer, and you call it straight down the line. You're honest. You'll be critical of the Bucks when it matters, but you do it in a way that it's not mean or negative. It just is. You state the facts. When there's a context that needs to be stated, even if it's not flattering to the Bucks, you say it, and you just don't hear. I don't know that any broadcaster in your position would have just said what you just said about Giannis, and that's part of the broadcast. It's part of why your broadcast is so good. There was even a time this season you guys were playing. God, it must have been Toronto or something, because you brought up the Norm Powell, OGN and Obi trade and how, for Gravis Vasquez, and how it didn't work. I'm like, there's just no one else would do that. So anyway, that's just that.
Well, but yeah, I think you commented. I saw your column.
I think
I kind of rhetorically just asked the ethers, where is Gravis Vasquez right now? You know, what is he doing now after Norman Powell just lit us up in that game? But, you know, I like to have fun with it, man. And it's the truth. You know what I mean? It's hard to swallow at times, but and getting back to Giannis and MVP, I was talking to Eric Name, our talented writer for The Athletic that covers the Bucks.
Great. I'm glad you brought it. He's great.
He is great. The clips that he posts is I mean, it gets on my nerves. He's so good with the way he breaks the games down. I mean, he's just really, really good. So I steal a lot of his stuff, but he talked about how Giannis, until he played well in the playoffs and the Bucks had playoff success, his writing partners and voters would never give him the MVP award. And so he didn't even finish top three this year. So that validates what I'm saying, is that you've got to do it to me, it doesn't make sense to be the most valuable player and you're not allowed to consider the most valuable part of the season. That's just me. I understand it's a regular season award. I'm not going to die on that hill, but I would love to see guys and people say, well, they've got the finals MVP. Well, Andre Iguodala was a finals MVP. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you could see a scenario where Chris Middleton could be the finals MVP. Giannis could be the overall regular season MVP. Devin Booker could be the finals MVP. Chris Paul would, you know what I mean? So that's not cut and dry that way. So that's just me, man.
You nailed the most interesting, I think, battleground of the series when the Suns have the ball, which is just how aggressively do the Bucks try to take away those mid-rangers, or how much do the Suns hurt them if they start off in a conservative defense? Let's flip to the other side. When the Bucks have the ball, and I realize this is difficult because we don't know if Giannis is going to play or not at the beginning, at least when the Bucks have the ball and Phoenix is on defense, what have you noticed about the Suns defense, or what's an area of the Bucks offense that you're going to be looking at when the series opens?
Well, Phoenix's defense, I mean, they are the best, I believe, during the playoffs in terms of restricted area opponent field goal percentage. So they've done a really good job, just like the Bucks are really strong in that area too. Another great stat is that DeAndre Ayton, when he went head up against Giannis, I thought Giannis, just from visually, just the eye test, had a lot of success against Ayton. But then you look at the matchup numbers, and Giannis was like 10 for 24 matched up personally against Ayton. I think he was 17 for 21 against everybody else. You know, he had the big 47, whatever point game against Phoenix. So for me, Phoenix's defense and what the Bucks like to do, the Bucks are going to be similar to Atlanta. I mean, everybody, you hear the guys on TNT and how the Bucks need to go inside and dominate the paint. Well, that might happen a game, two games, but Monty Williams is too good of a coach to allow it to consistently be something that's going to get him beat. So they'll make the adjustment. Once again, this team is going to have to knock down some three-point shots. I said it going into game six down in Atlanta. Bucks would have to knock down 15 to 18. I just kind of had a number in my head. I thought they'd shoot about 40-plus based on how Atlanta would gear their defense toward Brook Lopez and protecting the paint more than they did when the Bucks just scored the 66 points in the paint the game prior to that. So the point is, Bucks and this team hadn't shot the ball. Like, they're 31-32% from the three-point line during the playoffs. This is a team that was top five three-point percentage during the season. To me, you know, the percentages have got to even out at some point. So I think this team is going to have to knock down some shots to win this series from the outside, some long perimeter shots, some three-point shots to win this series. But you got to also stay with that the fast-paced type of attack that they're using, because Drew Holiday is so good with the broken field. You know what I mean? Coming up, and he can find the crevices, find the gaps. His physicality can take advantage of whoever. If Chris Paul is matched up against him early on in transition, that'll be advantageous to Drew. Even Devin Booker, he can make him work and hopefully take something out of his leg. So, you know, it's a combination attacking the rim, but also looking to do what this team has done the last 3 years. It's been the personality of this team. They say "let it fly" is our motto, and I just don't think they'll go away from that too much. Especially if the Suns make the adjustments that you expect them to make.
Well, part of the reason they went so hard in the paint in those last two games against Atlanta was that Giannis wasn't there. So yeah. all the cutting baskets that Giannis usually gets went to Lopez and Portis. Now, they obviously also took advantage of, like, when they switched on defense and the same matchups came over to the other end when they got stopped. So they've got a guard on Portis or a guard on Lopez. They dump it in. But part of the, it's not like they were just feeding Brook Lopez against Clint Capella. It was like, all right, do some Olajuwon stuff, Brook. It was cuts and stuff. And the floor being more open without Giannis was part of that. So I think this is going to be a fun series. I really just hope Giannis is 90%. I hope we get to see real Giannis for most of the series, because I think these teams are pretty evenly matched. It should be a fun series.
Well, and so a fun fact too is that the starting lineup for the Bucks never played together during the regular season. We picked up PJ Tucker in March 1st, I believe. Played 31 minutes during the playoffs. They had a 150 per 100 possessions offensive rating, which is crazy. But a 97 per 100 possessions defense. So this kind of patchwork, PJ Tucker, Bobby Portis, Brook, Drew, and Chris Middleton, and we got to talk more about Chris Middleton, I'm sure we will, but it's just played phenomenally, man. It's been crazy how well they've kind of meshed without having played any time together during the regular season. I think during the playoffs, they may have played 10 minutes together. So anyway, but here's the thing about Giannis. Giannis, his elasticity as an athlete, I've seen him, Zach, sprain ankles, twist knees. There was a game, I forget who we were playing, but he was in pregame warm-up, shooting around. Something happened with his knee. We caught it on camera, and you could see him go and rub his knee, limp off
Portland,
the floor.
In Portland. It was in Portland.
Yeah, it was in Portland. It was in Portland. And Paschke and I were like, okay, he's done. Not playing tonight. Probably be out 3 or 4 days. He plays in the game, scores 40-whatever points in that game. I think he sits out the next game. So the point is, I expect him – I'm not sure if it'll happen tomorrow night. I'm pretty certain that it will. I don't know anything officially, but I really expect him to be out there and then not miss too much time based on his history of quick recoveries from injuries like that.
If I have Marcus Johnson on the podcast, there are two things that I have to ask about that are not related to the Milwaukee Bucks team of the present. One is history, which we'll get to. And the second is your, I'm just going to say it, your decorated Hollywood career as both actor and screenwriter. Okay. So first, I was going back and refreshing my memory on the 80s Bucks and how close you guys got. And I had forgotten about this. You mentioned it early on. Game 7 against the Sixers in 81 in the second round. Now, the Sixers go on to lose the conference finals against Boston, also in 7, an epic Celtics comeback. I had forgotten, number one, it's in Philly. Number two, only 6,000-plus fans showed up. The arena was like half empty because it was Easter. And maybe other reasons. Number three, you guys lose by one. And you mentioned the out of bounds play and Philly runs out the clock. And then there's a 2-hour delay because the Bucks protest or demand a review of a potential 24 second violation because Philly got a bunch of offensive rebounds and it was unclear if one of the offensive rebounds had hit the rim and like, well, should they reset the game? They like lent to a local TV station with the coaches to look at VCR recordings of the shot. So like, what's going on in those 2 hours? Are you already gone? Is the game? Do you have any memory of that? That is wild.
Nah, man. And you know, as a player, you don't expect anything like that to really make a difference. I mean, it's a good try by the organization, but I think we'd all pretty much accepted the fact that you know, we had lost an opportunity to move on and play against the Celtics. And it was a great game 7. I had like 36 going against Doc. I used to always joke that you know, I had to work overtime because I'd have to guard Doc at one end and then try and score against Bobby Jones at the other end. So it was just a great series, 7-game series. And I think I read about that after the fact, maybe years after the fact, that the protest and the review of the film and all that. But as a player, you're just so upset and so ticked off that you know, I got to Milwaukee and I thought that we would definitely get to the finals, especially after my third year around the All-Star break. We picked up Bob Lanier. We finished the season 20-6, I believe. We lose to the Sonics in a 7th game. That's when we were in the Western Conference. And it just taught me a valuable lesson about how to approach it. I came out really cool that 7th game. Like, I know, you know, we got this, you know, we're going to win this game. And the Sonics came out like alley cats. Johnny Johnson was all up in my face talking to him. I'm like, yeah, Johnny, we're cool. What are you doing, man? You know, Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson. We're cool. LA guys. Gus at USC, Dennis at Pepperdine, Compton guy. But it's like, man, you know, this is like life or death. And it taught me a valuable lesson how to approach moments like that. You've got, and again, that's why I think I mentioned tweeting about game 7s, about how you got to go out there and just, you know, and just play like your life depends on it. And that's how you got to approach these finals games. Even though I've never been there, I've watched enough of them to know that it's the toughness element. You can scheme out all the defense, offense stuff you want to, but which is going to be the tougher minded team to me is going to be the team that hoists up the trophy at the end.
You had 36 points and 9 rebounds on 16 of 25 shooting in that game. Yeah, that's a badass performance. That's a badass performance.
I got player of the game from CBS on a losing team. That was one of the rare times that, you know, that CBS gave out the player of the game to player from the losing team. So that was, you know, that's worth something. I'd rather win the game, obviously, but hey, you know, I tried my best.
Well, and just to give you an idea of how good those, I don't want to dwell on the near misses, but you know, you lose to Philly in game 7 of that series. And again, Celtics Sixers went to 7 the next round. 82, you lose to Philly again. 83, you sweep the Celtics in the second round. Bill Fitch got fired because of that series, basically. And they moved, they changed. So you got a coach fired in Boston. And then you run into the faux Sixers team, and you're the only team that takes a game off that team in the playoffs. Like, that doesn't sound like much, but like, that's your opposition during that time. We're not talking about like a run of the mill great team. We're talking about two absolutely loaded teams. And you guys were right in that conversation. It's just hard to beat those teams four times.
Yeah, and it's funny. I used to get into an argument with Stephen A. Smith. When a team loses in five games, it's not a competitive series. We lost in five to the Sixers. And if you look at those scores, we lost by, I don't know, two or three points. I mean, there was a missed shot, a three not taken in one of the early games. So we were right there, and at least probably three of the five games had an opportunity to win. But to me, that was always the unfair part about it. I wish they would have done what the commissioner did to the Lakers when they picked up Chris Paul. Adding Moses Malone to Dr. J and Mo Chi, Bobby Jones, and Caldwell Jones is a guy that doesn't get enough credit. Just a great defensive player, 6'11", quick feet, used to give me fits on the defensive end when he guarded me. And even the Celtic teams. I mean, between Larry Bird and McHale and Parrish and that crew, I mean, you know, it was disappointing at the time, obviously, Zach, but looking back on it, you know, these are like all-time great front lines and teams that the organization's put together. And I used to always say that if we would have picked up Bob Lanier, instead of him being 32-33 when we picked him up from Detroit, if we could have gotten him at 29-30, it might have been different, because even at 32-33, he was still a force, but he was a 25 and 12 guy just 3 years prior, because his knees were pretty much shot by the time we got him. So, hey, it is what it is, man. But, you know, we competed and had a good time doing it.
If only starting your fitness journey was as easy as starting this podcast. The truth is, all the lift big, get big, and beach body ready in 3 weeks pressure stops most of us from even starting. And starting is what matters most. It's everything. Wherever you're beginning, wherever you want to be, Peloton encourages you to just start. With thousands of classes to get you moving and doing what you can. If that's a 10-minute low impact class, they've got those. And when you're ready, take it up a gear with a 30-minute live DJ ride. Start with Peloton and find instructors that will keep you motivated to stay on your fitness journey. Learn the basics and build from there. Remember, doing something is everything. Get started with a Peloton bike or bike plus rental at onepeloton.com/bike/rentals. Terms apply. You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes, catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them. You name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
When people discuss and debate the best performance in a movie by a professional basketball player, a professional athlete, we always default to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in Airplane. And he was great. He was great. And I'm always like, Marcus Johnson and White Men Can't Jump, that's the gold standard. It's a great role. You kill it. And it's memorable. And you've told a lot. Everyone asked you about White Men Can't Jump, so I apologize in advance for asking you about White Men Can't Jump. You've told all the stories about pickup games. And I saw you on Dan Patrick's show a couple weeks ago, or maybe it was last week, talking about what Woody and Wesley Snipes were doing, let's just say off the floor, and the party at Woody Harrelson's house. And Woody trying to call you for a foul in a pickup game. I mean,
impugning my integrity. I mean, that's the worst trash talk I've ever heard in my life, man. Come on.
I mean, how long are you on the set? I mean, you're in what? Are you in like, you're in like three or four scenes, I think. I haven't seen the movie recently, but it's not just the one scene. You're in a few. How long are you on set? Are there outtakes that you're proud of? Like, it's an all-time great performance by an athlete.
Well, the thing that stands out, we had a 6-week training camp in South Central Los Angeles at Rancho Park, near not too far from where I live in the Baldwin Hills View Park area, real nice area. I think the highest per capita income of a predominantly black neighborhood in the country. So it's really, I mean, here's a story for you. When I moved to this area from really deep in South Central when I was 11. So I'm on the playgrounds playing sandlot touch football. I'm quarterbacking, and my right end was Ray Charles Jr. and my left end was Ike Turner Jr. So this is the kind of neighborhood that I'm living in, the people that I'm, you know, that I'm playing, playing ball with, you know, and so a lot of great athletes, a lot of great entertainers from this neighborhood. But so we go through this 6-week training camp. And so we've got to do just a basic 3-man weave that Wesley Snipes would mess up every single time. Now, Dick Baker was the coach at Loyola Marymount for a number of years. He was responsible, he and Rob Ryder, for kind of putting us through the paces, getting everybody in game shape for the filming of this movie. And so if you messed up the drill, 3-man weave, you had to do it again. So Wesley Snipes would mess up 5, 6, 7 times. He could just not get the hang of this 3-man. So what wound up happening, and I started it off, whenever Wesley would get to the front of the line, you found yourself with him as a partner for this 3-man weave, along with another person. So I would like, oh, my shoestring's untied. Hey, go ahead of me, man. You take my spot. So everybody started doing that over and over again. Anytime Wesley was at the front of the line, you'd have 5 or 6 guys. Oh, yeah, I got a little bit of I need to go get retaped. I got to rub some analgesic balm on my hamstring. Go ahead, man. You got me. So finally, Wesley cut on, and he was like, okay, I see what you EMFers are doing. I know what y'all are doing. Just give me 2 weeks. I'm going to show you. And after 2 weeks, he kind of got it down. But, we had a great time. We had a ball on that set. Another funny moment was when I came out of my trailer for lunch, and I was in my character of Raymond, this ghetto kind of dude, and there was some music blasting, a good funky beat, maybe Atomic Dog by Funkadelics. So I come out of my trailer like kind of dancing like the character would dance, you know, just doing my thing. And Rosie Perez, who was an original fly girl, she sees me and she gets all excited. Oh, I see you. She comes up and we just start cooking, man. We just start dancing, me and her. And I'm just thinking to myself, man, I'm trying to hold my own against this fly girl. Let me just, you know, it's like Peter walking out of the boat on the water. When you think about it, you sink to the bottom. So don't let me think about it. Let me just keep dancing, man, and just stay in this character and hang with her as long as I could. But we had a great time on that set, man.
Who else is in those pickup games? Are you playing 3-on-3, 5-on-5? Like, what's, I know you and Woody, and I guess Wesley's playing, and you talked about Woody barking about fouls and all this play. Like, who are there other pro players or pro level players that they brought in? Who else is in these games?
Most of the guys are really good college level players. Nigel McGill was a guy that played at UCLA. He's been in a lot of films. He's been the technical advisor for a lot of movies. Another funny story with Nigel, he was a technical advisor on the first Michael Jordan movie Space Jam. And so, you know, he's my boy, UCLA. He's a Belizean guy. I wound up coaching the Belizean national team in 2010 because of Nigel. He's always looking out for me. We're really, really good friends. And so Nigel has a money-making proposition for me to do. Come down to the Space Jam lot and be one of the monsters. And so to do that, you had to put on this green acrylic skin-tight suit and just go through some basketball movements and $2,000. You know, I said, okay, that sounds easy enough. I go down there, Zach, me and some other ball players, 6'6", 6'7". I'm not in great shape at that point. Got this big midsection and all that. I put on this tight green acrylic suit and I just look, I look crazy. And I told Nigel, man, I can't do this, man. He's like, what's wrong? I just, you know, I'm an actor, man. I can't go out here in this green acrylic suit, looking all fat and out of shape. And so he's like, I understand, MJ. Don't worry, we'll get somebody else to do it. So he got somebody else to do it and gave me another scene in the movie doing something else. But yes, that was my Space Jam story. My ego and pride, man, wouldn't let me be seen in this tight green acrylic suit and get feel like feel laughed at and mocked and all that stuff. So that's my Space Jam story.
Well, I haven't seen White Men Can't Jump in probably 15 years, so I don't know how it's aged, let's say. But I'll say this. I was on The Jump maybe 2 or 3 years ago. It was me, Rachel, and Paul Pierce. And I don't know. I think someone had done something on the best basketball movie ever, and we were maybe going to do a segment on it. And Rachel said, what's your guys' favorite basketball movie ever? And Paul and I almost simultaneously said White Men Can't Jump. Everyone expects the answer to be Hoosiers. Again, I haven't seen the movie in a long time, but both of us said White Men Can't Jump. Your character in that movie is based on a real person. You wrote a screenplay about that person, but you told me today you've written another screenplay that I was not aware of. That sounds really cool. I didn't know you were like a prolific writer as well. This is not, it's a lot of talents, but tell us about this other screenplay.
Well, the other screenplay is the first one you mentioned is about Reggie Harding, who was the first, one of the first high school to pro guys, early Detroit, street guy, the siren call of the streets was always his undoing, bounced around the league. Anyway, so that's the first really, really, really great story. I would love to get Anthony Davis, as a matter of fact. He's 6'10", Reggie was 6'10", 6'11", to try and play that role. I think with me kind of walking him through, I think he'd be great for it, just watching him in commercials. This other screenplay is called Burning for Justice. It's about integrating the LA Fire Department right around the time of Brown versus Board of Education in the mid-50s. A group of really courageous Black men who named themselves the Stentorians, which means a loud, powerful voice. They kind of formed this support group to help each other kind of walk through what was just abject racism at that time. And one guy had feces placed on his pillow when he laid down to sleep at night. I mean, they wouldn't let the Black firemen, you couldn't even talk to the white firemen at that point. They give them the silent treatment. They didn't come to their aid during certain drills and rescue situations that were dangerous. So, but this group of Black firemen, man, I had an opportunity, Zach, to interview about five of them over the last 10 years. Me and my writing partner, Todd Wasserman, to interview these guys. And most of them have passed away. One, Reggie Ballard Sr., just passed away about 2 weeks ago. But just listening to them and the stories they tell, my point is this, is that the league does a great job, man, of promoting all these superhero movies, the Avengers and all that. You know, let's put some of that energy behind some stories about real people. And give these real men who were trailblazers in this social justice movement that we're so actively involved in now, let's give them their props in a way that that would be good for the league, good for the community, good for society, and I think good for the players. And so I got a part for Steph Curry in this movie. I mean, there's a fireman by the name of Arnett Hartsfield, you know, who was a law student, USC, while he was a fireman, but family man, really great role. Got a part for Steph Curry. I've approached this production company, Unanimous, didn't get much traction. I tried to go through Dale, his dad, same kind of situation. So I'm putting it out there right now on your show, man. Come on, Steph, take a look at this screenplay. It's perfect for what you want to do in your production company. And all you got to do is take a look at it. You want to pass on it, fine, but at least give it an opportunity.
Well, look, it sounds like when you texted me Stentorians, I had not heard of this story, and I Googled around and I started reading about it. I said, this would make a really moving and real movie. I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole, but look, you got to go. You got finals to prep for. Marcus Johnson, I'm happy that you get to see the Bucks in the finals. I'm happy that we get to listen to you on broadcasts, and I hope that continues. It's a thrill to do this with you. And boy, next time I'm in Milwaukee, let's go grab a beer. Let's go out to dinner or something. It'd be great to see you.
Sounds great, man. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for the support. I appreciate it.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.